The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show. On today's show, we are going to attack that pile of email questions that we've got kind of built up here. We're going to try to knock out as many of those as we can. I know we have several Social Security questions. Also, if anyone would like to call in live, we'll be taking live calls as well. I've had quite a few in the past couple weeks, which has slowed down our ability to answer these email questions, but more than happy to take your live calls whenever you are listening live. Most of you listen to this kind of after the fact, recorded via the podcast that we have. Shows up on iTunes, also the Google Play podcast area as well. If your favorite podcast software should have the Retirement and IRA Show access. So however you listen, that's great. But if you want to listen live and have the ability to call in and ask us a question, we can go then back and forth in kind of a live Q&A session. We record this usually between 2:30, 3:30 p.m. in on Mondays here, Mountain Time. So it is 2:48 p.m. Mountain Time on Monday, September 10th right now. So right now I don't think we have any live listeners. They usually kind of drop in as we go. But if you want to be prepared to call in, the phone number is 970-530-0556. That's 970-530-0556.
But if nobody's listening to us right now,
I said if they want to be ready to do it, as they're listening to the recording, they can write that number down so that the following Monday they'll be ready to go.
Just wanted to point that out.
So, yes. Right now, there's no one listening. Just
nobody.
You. You're listening to me.
I'm listening to you. You're listening to me.
That's it. So, yeah. That's all I had to say. You have the questions, Jim.
I do. This is the Q&A version of the Retirement and IRA Show. We're going to be coming out with fancy new beginnings. We have a new marketing woman here in the office named Jo, and this is going to be one of the tasks she's been tasked with, was to come up with a new theme song for both shows. We'll be getting rid of our current theme song, and that way there'll be two slightly different theme songs introducing each show. And if you remember, we are going in a different direction on the podcast. Excuse me. We're going to dedicate one whole show to just questions, and that's going to be called the Q&A show, and that's what you're listening to right now. This is going to be a Q&A show. We had 23 Qs last week. We didn't get to any A's because we actually had enough callers, and we also summarized a question from a previous show, Chris, as you remember last week. We finished answering that question, and we never got to any new emails, so we hope to get to them today. We got four more emails added to the 23 we had last week. So my simplistic understanding of math is we're up to 27 unanswered questions. So we will try to plow through that today as best we can. Ten words or less is going to be our answers, according to you.
Well, I think it'd be very efficient.
We'd get through all 27, that is for sure, in 10 words or less. The problem is Chris kind of goes on and on and on and on and on. And before you know it, what could be a rather simple answer has gone down several rabbit holes. And we get through one or two emails. But we just have to deal with Chris and his little idiosyncrasies.
Yeah, I'm trying to work on that.
You are trying to work on that, I know. So we'll just see how that goes. But let's start jumping into this. I do want to thank all our iTunians, be they Androidians or iTunians. We call both classes of people podcastians. So we want to thank everybody for listening to us. Remember, we are live planning, live practicing financial planners here in the state of Colorado, but we work with everyone throughout the United States. Chris is known for his knowledge on Social Security far more than I am. I'm known on my understanding and knowledge of IRAs. Together, we work well together. And Chris, we are going to begin with a Social Security question.
Perfect.
That I think you'll be able to answer. You haven't seen this question.
Uh-oh.
But I think you'll like this question. I'm pretty sure you'll be able to nail an answer on it as well. But I think you'll like the beginning. It begins, Jim, Chris, and Todd et al. Now, Justin is no longer with us, but I'm sure he wouldn't quite appreciate being called Todd. Do we ever have a Todd?
We did not. That's okay. I called him Junior.
I called him Junior, but I never called him Todd.
I don't know. Yeah.
I don't know how he came up with Todd. Jim, Chris, and Todd et al. Et al means everyone else, right?
Yeah.
And that would have been probably Darcy and Peter and things of that nature.
Yeah. I don't know.
I don't know how he got Todd out of Justin.
That's okay. Maybe he was referring to someone completely different.
I don't know. But it begins, Jim, Chris, Todd et al. I really appreciate you guys and the time you give to educating the public on how Social Security really works under the hood. Mm-hmm. I really appreciate Chris. I think he meant to write Jim, but for some reason it came out Chris.
It
could have been Todd, he meant. I really appreciate Chris. He is always so precise and measured. Oh, no, he was definitely talking about me. I feel I can take anything he says to the bank.
Oh,
that's a lot of pressure. Yeah, that's a lot of pressure on you, my man. And, wow, I probably should have gave you this email first. I hope you can nail it.
I hope I don't disappoint him after that.
That's quite the introduction.
Yeah.
Okay, now he gets to the nitty-gritty. Question. Mm-hmm. I have been trying to figure out survivor benefit options and have been listening to your podcast tagged with the topic survivor benefits. Mm-hmm. Now, for iTunians...
It's a good place to start.
It is a good place to start. For iTunians who don't know, this gentleman, his email actually came to us from our Social Security blog, helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, a blog that Chris kind of took over about 6 months after we started it 3 years ago, and have really been doing all the blog posts since. I do apologize for not having time to keep up
on
that.
That's okay. You need to do Help With My IRA blog or something.
I got tons to do right now. And... this is where the email came in from. So any iTunians who didn't know that, if you go to helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, it pops up our audio blog site. Chris posts a brief, usually about, what, 8 minutes long?
Sometimes shorter, sometimes a little longer, but yeah. It doesn't take long to listen to a post, and there'll be a written post on the topic, and then in the audio, I kind of summarize what was in the written portion and a lot of times provide another example or expand on a few things in the audio portion. But you can get the core of the issue answered in the text post if you don't want to take the time to listen to the audio blog. But I embellish things a bit in the audio blog.
But again, that's helpwithmysocialsecurity.com.
And you can search there, and that's what they're talking about.
And that's what he's talking about. You can
search for survivor benefits, and all the past blog posts about survivor benefits would come up. And you can
Who comes up with the keywords on the blog, you or Julia, which is now Joe?
Julia, probably.
Okay. It might behoove us to let Joe know, who the new Julia, let her know that he used these keywords.
I think she knows.
Okay. Never mind. All right, so I'll continue with this question. Mm-hmm. If someone began claiming a spousal benefit before their full retirement age, and then their spouse dies, can the surviving spouse continue to receive the spousal benefit and wait until their survivor full retirement age to claim the survivor benefit? I used to think the answer was yes, and it could be beneficial to wait, but I cannot find anywhere that you have addressed this directly. And then he goes on to say he's getting conflicting information from the web.
Lots of that happening, especially with Social Security.
So this is from Georgia, by the way. The listener's from Georgia. We call him George, as always.
George from Georgia.
Why don't you help educate him on what will happen in his scenario?
Okay. So the simple answer is you cannot collect spousal benefits on a deceased person. So let me set the stage with that comment. So spousal benefits will cease when someone passes away. That being said, you are not forced to switch to the survivor benefit at that time. But if you want to continue receiving some sort of benefit, you only have two choices. One is to switch to the survivor benefit, even if it's before your full retirement age, and thus be collecting a reduced survivor benefit since you are claiming early. Or fall back and claim your own Social Security benefit if you have earned one. He doesn't make clear in his hypothetical scenario that there is the spouse having their own benefit, just as they're collecting a spousal benefit. Now, you might think, well, then it's just a spousal. No, that's not true. When you collect a spousal benefit, if you have earned and are eligible to receive your own benefit, especially if you're claiming before your full retirement age, which was part of this story, you are deemed or forced to claim your own retirement benefit first, and then they cap it up. They fill it up if you're due any extra because of a spousal benefit with what's called the spousal offset. It's the extra amount on top. So people always say, well, I'm collecting my spousal benefit. When in reality, when you open the hood to connect to his what's under the hood comment, when you lift up the hood and look at it, you're really collecting your own benefit first and then being added to a spousal benefit if you are due an additional benefit because of your spousal qualification. So if you have your own, you could tell Social Security, no, I don't want to switch over to the survivor benefit because I don't want to permanently reduce it. I want to wait for 1, 2, 3 years, however long it is, until you reach that point, and collect only my own benefit in the meantime, thus guaranteeing that for life, from your full retirement age to mortality, to the end, that you'll collect the largest survivor benefit that you're entitled to receive. But since he doesn't say anything about a person having their own benefit, if the spousal benefit is the only benefit, so say there was a non-working spouse who's collecting a spousal benefit prior to their full retirement age, the two choices they would have would be to switch to the survivor benefit to continue on, and thus it being permanently reduced, or not taking a benefit at all. Just because you started your spousal benefit, when that goes away, you're not forced to. They don't say, hey, since you started the spousal benefit, you have to go take the survivor benefit now. If you decide it's better for you to turn off all benefits, well, you don't really have a choice. You don't have your own to claim in this scenario. To say, I don't want that survivor benefit yet, you absolutely can wait collecting nothing for some period of time until you reach your full retirement age for survivor benefits and then turn it on. There'd be no advantage to waiting a day past that, since survivor benefits do not get any sort of delayed retirement credits if you delay past your full retirement age to claim survivor benefits. But since it is, since the one person has passed away, you're going to be living on just one Social Security benefit. You don't get both. And a lot of times it's best to try to maximize that in order to create the largest guaranteed monthly amount for the rest of your life with cost of living increases, which is a very attractive feature of Social Security, so it might make perfect sense to delay. But the crux of the question, going back to the beginning here, no, you cannot collect a spousal benefit anymore after your spouse passes away. When they pass away, no more spousal benefit can be collected. So you've got to fall back on either the other two available benefits, your own, if you have one, or the survivor benefit itself. So that was a lot more than 10 words, but...
It's all right. It's all right. We're used to that with you. I want to make sure, because I skipped some parts here, that we answered the rest of his question.
I think we nailed it. He can always write in with more. But I did want to add, even though he didn't mention specifically that this hypothetical spouse had their own benefit as well. He only talked about claiming a spousal benefit. I wanted to make it clear that it could be made up of their own benefit plus a spousal top-up or offset. And if that's the case, you would have a fallback position. You couldn't collect the spousal anymore, but you could collect only your own benefit if you were entitled to such a thing and wait for the survivor benefit to maximize itself at your full retirement age.
He sent a follow-up email shortly after this one.
Oh.
And he wanted to add one more part to the question.
Okay.
So maybe you'll know the answer to this or not. One part I forgot. If a current spouse is receiving a spousal benefit, just like he described, and the number holder dies, upon notification of death, the Social Security Administration automatically converts the spousal to a survivor. And we've already confirmed that. Am I correct?
Well, we've confirmed that you don't have to take that.
Right.
But
am I correct in assuming that the Social Security Administration would regard the date of death, or is it the date of notification, as the application date for the survivor benefit?
It's the date of death. It's that month. It's that month that it occurs. So there's not a... Because there could be a small delay in notification. So they don't rely upon the notification date. Everything is based upon the actual month that they died. So if there's a slight delay, they're going to fix everything as if they were notified in time to correct it. And there is some timing issue here, because a lot of times, say they died late in the month, they won't be notified in time to stop the deposit that's coming the month after. So they'll adjust everything, though. But it is based on the actual date of death.
Okay.
And they'll be notified by funeral homes, notify the family members can notify. So there's a variety of ways Social Security will learn of a death. And it is best if you proactively let them know so they can adjust it. Because what you don't want to have happen is to be overpaid and then they have to do all kinds of paperwork and a withholding of benefits to fix things where they shouldn't have paid you, especially if you want to turn it off and not have it switched to a survivor benefit. If you want to wait on that, you should let them know immediately that's your intention, so they don't automatically do anything based on assuming what you'd like to happen. I suspect they will default to assuming that you want to collect the survivor benefit. I haven't confirmed with anyone yet that that is the default action, but I do know for sure that you are not forced to do it. But a lot of times, even though you're not forced to do it, they do have a default process that they follow. We've talked about that before with claiming retroactive benefits. The assumption, the default application when you go in after your full retirement age, this is a different topic now, is to process it as if assuming that you want the retroactive claim to be made so you can collect that lump sum for the months you air quote missed. That's the default. You have to proactively tell them, no, I don't want to do that if that's not your intention. So that's why I'm mentioning it. The default action might cause you to switch to the survivor benefit when in reality that's not what you want to have happen. So communication with the Social Security office is best just to make sure things work the way you'd like them to.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. So we've got 26 more emails to get through.
Perfect. Check one off, one down.
One down.
26 to go.
26 more to go. I think that double email counted as two because it's printed on two pieces of paper. I might have counted that
as two.
So that could be technically two down.
Perfect.
One emailer, two emails. Because I answer by sheets of I count rather by sheets of paper, not by individual emailers.
Okay.
So, okay, this one is technically a two-part, but you can see someone taped. I didn't do this. Someone taped.
Interesting. They follow-up.
There was a follow-up to the initial question. Okay. So I usually have staff print these for me, and they kind of printed, cut, and taped this together.
It's high-tech.
It is high-tech here in the office of Jim Solnier Associates because Jim Solnier is not high-tech, and he still uses paper. But this paper thing seems to be working. I haven't lost any lately. Don't look at me that way.
Well, lately.
If people saw the look you just gave me.
It was a quick glance.
My fans would be running to my protection.
Quick glance, that's all.
A glance? Oh, my God. If looks could kill, I'd be having a heart attack right now. No, I am not as techy as Chris. Chris, I don't know how he does it. He just understands tech stuff. I don't know why I don't as well.
I'm a geek.
You are a tech geek.
Yeah.
Okay. This one is right up our alley. It has to do with IRAs, and this is the Retirement and IRA Show. So we're going to momentarily get off the Social Security bandwagon. Out of the 27 emails, by the way, that we had, 23 are on Social Security.
Oh, my gosh. Well, just the proof. The reason why we started that blog, not to segue too much, but the reason why we have helpwithmysocialsecurity.com.
People need help.
Is there's what should be simple in idea. The whole claiming of Social Security, once you dig into it, there's all these different choices and options. And when you have multiple benefits where you might qualify for them, the coordination of claiming, and then you've got a spousal in there. So
but
then,
what
then
this
you've
shows,
got divorces, and you've got, you know, it's just lots of.
But more importantly, it shows, and you can tell that Social Security is a governmental bureaucracy. Because if Social Security was private and in competition, not a monopoly, but in competition with other private Social Security providers, and I'm certainly not advocating for this, I'm just highlighting the inefficiencies of government, there would be helplines staffed with highly knowledgeable people where all these questions would be answered on a helpline. Try getting help from Social Security and then get accurate help is hard. How many times have we been told people listen to our show, go to Social Security, and they're told they can't do something. They get back a hold of us. We tell them, absolutely, you can. And then you have to ask for the office what again?
The technical expert or the manager.
Expert at the office. And it just becomes a nightmare. And they wait weeks to get their appointment and half hour, 20 minutes, 40 minutes, whatever it takes on the phone. And it's a nightmare. But that's what you get with governmental monopolistic bureaucracies. Not picking on government, it's just the way it is.
Yeah.
So to me, all these questions, 23 Social Security questions.
Our recommendation is go in armed with the information ahead of time so that you're going to ask specifically for something. And then if you get any pushback, you've got some documentation. You can get it cleared up. But relying on them to draw the picture clearly for you for your choices, that would be a folly. I would say don't do that.
Well, let's go down an IRA road now.
Okay.
Okay, so this email came in. I don't know from where. They don't list their state, not that we're keeping track anymore. But it begins. A father who owns an IRA dies after he began taking his RMDs.
Mm-hmm.
So there is not much. You can see how short this email is.
Right.
Very short.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to extrapolate a lot of assumptions from this. The father was over his required beginning date. And that's key here. I'm going to make that assumption. Because if the gentleman, you have to begin taking required minimum distributions. That's what RMDs stand for. By April 1st of the year following the year you turn 70 and a half.
Mm-hmm.
But RMD, that's when you have to take your first one. But RMD rules themselves begin in the year you turn 70 and a half. So if he turns 70 and a half in, say, July or say September, in September of 2018, he turns 70 and a half in 2019, 2019 is the year RMD rules apply, even though his required beginning date, April 1st of the year following the year he turns 70 and a half, isn't until April of 2020. And if he dies anywhere between January of 2019 and April 1st of 2020, everything I'm about to say doesn't apply. So I don't
know. Even if he's taken the RMD.
Well, it's because RMD rules apply, except in the case of death. It's the only time you can get out of having to take an RMD is to die.
Right.
And if,
and
you,
if you die before your
required beginning, beginning date,
if you happen to have taken money out, it's not considered an RMD.
No, it is.
Nor that you've actually...
If you
that's the point I'm making here. Oh. We don't know how old this person is.
No, so I'm making the assumption he is past April 1st of the year following the year he turned 70 and a half. He's past his required beginning date. If you die between January 1st of the year you turn 70 and a half and April 1st of the following year, if you die in that black hole, so to speak, the RMD rules are a little bit different. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole because it might not be necessary. If this listener is in that situation, let me know and I'll augment my answer. So the first assumption I am making is the father dies after April 1st of the year following the year he turned 70 and a half.
Okay.
Okay. The mother inherits the IRA from the deceased father.
Mm-hmm.
And begins taking her own required minimum distributions. Now, I'm going to make another assumption here. I'm assuming she moved the IRA because she is allowed to into her own IRA. And the reason I made that assumption is what he writes. Begins taking her own required minimum distributions.
Mm-hmm.
That just tells me, and the fact that it's a spouse.
Right.
Only a spouse is allowed to move an inherited IRA from a deceased spouse into their own IRA and take, essentially, their own required minimum distributions. So I would assume also the wife has also reached an age where she is past April 1st of the year following the year she turned 70 and a half. She's past the required beginning date for herself.
Okay.
So those some pretty broad assumptions. The mother names her daughter, age 57, as her beneficiary. That's the other reason why I assume that this inherited IRA was moved into the mother's own IRA, because he doesn't say the daughter was named as successor beneficiary, and we spoke about this recently on the podcast. If you name someone as beneficiary of an inherited IRA, in other words, if the mother didn't move it into her own, she left it in the deceased husband's name and acted as a beneficiary of the IRA, she would name a successor beneficiary to step in. He didn't word that. He said names the daughter as her beneficiary. Mm-hmm. So I just assumed again.
Yep.
So you can see the assumptions.
So to summarize all this, the father passed away. The mother moved the IRA into her own. So now all the money's in one IRA under the mother's name. And that IRA, the beneficiary, they named the 57-year-old daughter. And both the mother and the father were past their required beginning date.
Right.
As you, so that was the, that's kind of the summary if you lost.
And listen, do you say, and I confused our listeners?
Well, no, you're very specific and precise in your,
but
in
you
your
were
description.
Very brief.
But just to tighten it up a little to make sure everybody's on board before we proceed.
Got
because
it.
Now we're
because
gonna,
we just want the listener to know.
I can see where his question's probably going.
Yeah.
How's the RMD
situation
for the daughter?
Yeah. So I just want to point out to all our iTunian listeners, and especially the emailer themselves, if any of the facts differ from the way Chris just described it, our answer is should not be listened to.
Correct.
Okay. And then he forgot to ask the question. That's why he sent a second email.
So he gave us the details.
He gave us the setup, but forgot to ask the question. So he wrote back, sorry, forgot to ask my question. The question is, can the daughter take required minimum distributions based on the daughter's age, or must she use the mother's age since the mother had previously inherited the IRA?
So it wasn't, well, the reason isn't because she inherited the IRA. The reason is her age, correct? The mother's age.
Right, but
that's going to determine the answer to this question.
Well, remember, in the previous email, he says the mother dies. Mm-hmm. So the mother died after the naming the daughter. Now he's asking, does the daughter take required minimum distributions based on the daughter's age? Or must she use the mother's age since the mother had inherited the IRA?
Yes, that last comment, though, that doesn't determine the answer to this question, Jim.
No. I'm not sure.
Give the answer, then I'll clarify.
Okay, thank you. Because you're confusing me, so you might be confusing our listeners. So what the gentleman is asking, and the assumptions Chris and I have made, father dies, mother inherits the IRA, mother moves the IRA into her own IRA, mm-hmm. mother names a 57-year-old daughter as primary beneficiary of said mm-hmm. IRA. We're going to assume there's no other beneficiaries. And then the mother passes away. So a 57-year-old woman inherits an IRA from her mother that had previously been inherited from the mother's husband. We don't know if it's the father.
And the mother is past her required beginning date.
Correct. Mother dies after April 1st of the year following the year she turned 70 and a half. Mm-hmm. So the short answer is no. She does not, she being the daughter, does not have to use the mother's remaining life expectancy because the daughter is a primary beneficiary, not a successor beneficiary. If the mother had never moved the IRA into her own, if she left it as an inherited IRA and she was merely the beneficiary of a decedent, that's why inherited IRAs are sometimes called decedent IRAs. Beneficiary IRAs, inherited IRAs, they all go by the same name. Well, they all go by different names, but they operate the same. But that's not the case here. The mother moved it to her own. The daughter was a primary beneficiary. When you are a primary beneficiary or contingent beneficiary, not a successor beneficiary, you get to use your life expectancy for the required minimum distribution tables. But if the mother had not done that, she left it as an inherited IRA, the daughter would have had to have used the remaining single life expectancy of the mother. So if the mother was well into her 80s, and we don't know because there's no ages given, the daughter would have had to have closed the IRA in less than probably 8 years. But as a primary beneficiary of an IRA the mother owned, it doesn't matter that it originally came from the father. Once it goes into the mother's own IRA, the IRS considers its previous ownership structure null and void.
And that was the point I was making. It was the fact that part of it was inherited from the dad has nothing to do with her ability to stretch it
right
out now. Once it's in there, it's mixed in with the mother's, and it's all the mother's now. Even if it treated as if it was the mother's from the beginning, when it has to do with what the primary beneficiaries can now do with it. So his little comment about how the rules might be specifically because there was the piece inherited from the father first, that part is irrelevant. That part doesn't have to do with the answer. Once it's mixed in there,
yep,
whether it was all the mother's or half the mother's and half the dad's, doesn't matter.
Perfect.
At that point.
Right. I think we answered that one.
Yeah. Now, one little side note is the mother has reached the RMD age. If she hasn't taken her RMD in the year of death, the daughter's going to have to take that.
Absolutely. And unless then, she dies before her required beginning
date. Yeah, but we assumed
she died after. Right.
So if we're holding to our assumptions, if the mother's taken it, all good. She gets to, the 57-year-old daughter gets to stretch it out based on her life expectancy. Or she could close it sooner. She doesn't have to stretch it out, right? It's not a mandatory thing, but it's an option. But if she hasn't taken the RMD for the year that she died, that must be taken first by the daughter, calculated based on what her mother should have taken out before she can then start doing the math based on her life expectancy. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Absolutely, 100% correct. And in fact, we had an iTunian several years ago who fell into the odd rule that we have assumed doesn't apply here. And it was a gentleman, if you remember, from the East Coast who inherited an IRA from his partner, and they were legally married in the state that they resided in. And the partner had died after the year, after January 1st of the year he turned 70 and a half, but before April 1st of the following year. And the gentleman had who inherited it had listened to us in the past. We talked about this on a previous show, and he felt, I don't have to take a required minimum distribution, according to Jim on this show. He called up the custodian, which was Vanguard. Vanguard disputed it and said you had to take a required minimum distribution. So he contacted us. I told him, no, in fact, it is correct. You do not. I gave him a little bit of information. Mm-hmm. And the gentleman eventually got Vanguard to acknowledge that the phone rep was wrong, and you do not have to take the required minimum distribution.
And it was only because he had passed away prior to his required beginning date.
April 1st of the year.
Even though he'd reached the year when the calculation started, the requirement for withdrawing it hadn't come about yet in time. So as when he passed away, he'd never reached the point where he had to take
that's
one.
That's the only time you can avoid a required minimum distribution, is to die in that
window, that
15-month so window.
Yep.
So if you really want to avoid your RMD,
because
you want to stick it to the government, die between January 1st and April 1st of the following year.
Well, and if you happen to die before that, there was no RMD at all anyway because you hadn't reached 70 and a half.
And then leave all of your IRA to charity, and it'll escape taxation. So there's a downside to that. You're dead. But escaped
no
the taxes.
No taxes were ever paid.
Yes, that's right. Okay, so we have another question if we have time.
Oh, I think so.
Okay, it is subject proper titling of spouse's 401k.
Nice.
Okay. Hello, Jim. Mm-hmm. I also love your area of Loveland and Fort Collins. Hmm. Maybe because I used to work for a company that used to be HP. So it must have been one of the spinoff companies. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of spinoff companies.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, this area of Colorado is pretty big with the HP. Mm-hmm. They got a big campus.
HP and related businesses.
Entities, yes. So I have spent considerable time in our sites in Loveland and in Fort Collins. So he is an out-of-state iTunian who has been to Colorado many a times.
And likes it.
Yes. I enjoy listening to your team's podcast and have learned a lot on theory, but not sure how the nuts and bolts to execute the proper titling of an inherited 401k. So it kind of ties into the last. We've been talking about this a lot lately. We've had quite a few questions on this. Yeah. I don't know if a lot of people are dying or what. But he begins, my sister's husband passed away in April of this year at the young age of 52. Mm. I would have to say, yes, that is young.
That's young.
I am advising my sister, who is also 52, on what to do. The 401k custodian, I won't mention who it is, he does. The 401 custodian is with blank. Oh, can we mention it? Doesn't matter. I don't think it matters, does it?
I don't think it matters. And
yeah, we're not going to throw them
promoting
under the bus.
Transamerica. Them.
Yeah. Okay. The 401k custodian is with Transamerica. My sister was named designated beneficiary, and contingent beneficiaries are their three children.
Mm-hmm.
My sister's 401k is with Fidelity, and she wants to move the inherited 401k to Fidelity to centralize all her retirement accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, folks, she cannot move it to the Fidelity 401k.
Right. That we've clarified recently.
On previous show.
Cannot happen. You cannot roll over
No.
A 401k into another 401k, into another qualified plan. So it's not just 401k if you had other options like 457
plans. Even a spouse can't do it.
Correct. Nobody can.
Nobody can. You cannot roll over an inherited account into a qualified plan.
Right.
And a qualified plan is a 401k. But you can roll, excuse me, non-spouse beneficiary cannot do a rollover. Remember, the movement of a 401k, any 401k movement, whether it goes directly to another 401k or directly to an IRA, is always considered a rollover.
Right.
A non-spouse beneficiary cannot roll over with a what is known as a 60-day rollover. You can't take the money out. But a non-spouse beneficiary can roll over directly from one 401k to an IRA, only to an IRA. So when this gentleman says she wants to move the 401k to Fidelity, she cannot move it into her Fidelity 401k. She can move it into an inherited IRA at Fidelity. That is allowed.
Well,
but it's got to be done direct.
They're spouses. So she could move it into her own IRA at Fidelity.
Oh, that's right. I thought brother and sister. Mm-hmm. Nope. That's right. The
deceased is the spouse. Right,
the brother's
of the
trying to help
Correct.
The sister. Gotcha. The deceased is the
spouse. So when they move it, you could move it as an inherited IRA, but I don't know why one would want to do that when you have the option as the spouse to put it in your own, especially when they have kids. It'd be cleaner. She'd be able to manage it.
Here's one reason why she's going to want to not move it. She's only 52.
Yeah. So here's another. Yeah.
So if Maybe she moves move it, it mm-hmm. to her own IRA, which she'd be allowed to at Fidelity, if she moves it, and she withdraws money from that IRA, spending becomes tight, and she needs money. Mm-hmm. There will be a 10% penalty on putting it into her own IRA. Now, she can move it to an inherited 401k, an inherited IRA at Fidelity, and then withdraw from it without a 10% early withdrawal penalty because it's not her own IRA. Right. It's an inherited IRA. Or she can leave it as an inherited 401k.
They may not let her split it up. Remember how there's some 401ks. And the point is, what we recommend a lot of times is you've kind of been given a free pass here. There are certain activities that generate a free pass to get out of early withdrawal penalties. And one way is to be the beneficiary of an inherited retirement account. Then you have access to that money without the early withdrawal penalty, because what's one of the outs for the early withdrawal penalty? Death, right? So the account holder, the owner of the retirement account has died. Early withdrawal penalties have gone away. So a lot of times, especially when you have a situation where they're in their 50s here, they've got 7 years, roughly, before they'll reach the point where they can take out their own money. If she were to move all that into her own accounts, now it's under her own rules, and it's all locked up until 59 and a half. Where she might want to leave some money accessible without the penalty by leaving it in an inherited account. So one way to do that is leave it as the inherited 401k at the original 401k provider.
Or an inherited IRA.
Or an inherited IRA. Or she could move part of it to her own if she's allowed. Sometimes the 401k won't let you split it up. It's if you're going to take money out, you're going to take the whole thing.
That was one thing that I wanted to get to. The law allows this type of flexibility. The 401k may not.
Right.
And even though she can create an inherited 401k and leave it at Fidelity.
No,
at Transamerica.
Transamerica, yeah.
The Transamerica 401k documents could say if you take any distribution, you must move it all.
Right.
A lot of 401ks, folks, aren't really in business to deal with inherited accounts. They're a pain in the hiney for the custodian to deal with. They have required minimum distribution rules that are different for spouse or non-spouse. And you can often get people who might call them up and ask for, send me $2,000. And then a few months later, send me another $500. Then a few months later, send me $10,000. And that's not what the 401k wants to deal with. I have seen some 401ks that are very restrictive on how flexible they let retirees and those who inherit their accounts access the 401k money. I have seen other 401ks that are quite unrestrictive and give you, hey, whenever you need it, give us a call. So the woman clearly, according to the brother, does not want to keep everything at Transamerica, the deceased husband's 401k custodian. She'd like to move it to Fidelity. So if she moves it, what you and I are simply saying is if she wants some flexibility to access money, she, without the 10% early withdrawal penalty, she has to take the money from an inherited account. Because when the spouse moves the money to their own IRA, the IRS, again, will disregard where the money first came from. So the fact that it came from a decedent's 401k is now immaterial. The IRS doesn't even go back there and look. The IRS is going to say, this money came from your own IRA. You are under the age of 59 and a half, you must pay a 10% early withdrawal penalty. So to avoid that, you have to leave, the spouse has to leave, if that's important to her, to avoid the 10% early withdrawal penalty, she has to leave some or all of the 401k in some type of inherited account.
Right.
Either an inherited 401k, where Chris and I have already said there could be some restrictions on her flexibility of accessing it, or an inherited IRA. And the other great thing is the spouse at any time can move more money into her own IRA from the inherited account. So it's not an all or nothing.
Right.
So she can move the money from Transamerica to an inherited IRA at Fidelity and then decide a year or two from now how much she wants to put in her own 401k, because there are huge advantages to moving it into your own, and how much to leave in an inherited account until she reaches 59 and a half in case she needs to access some of it. And then after 59 and a half, she can move the rest to her own IRA. The spouse has that much flexibility, Chris.
Let me fix one thing that he just said, because he said move some of that inherited into her own 401k.
Oh, did I say that again?
Damn it. He meant in her own account, her own IRA account. Yeah. Now, once it's in her own IRA, if her 401k allows it, could she not roll it in? So there is a kind of a backdoor way to roll into it. But
don't
forget, hit your own.
Once it's in her own, it's her own. And
correct.
Where it previously came from does not matter.
Exactly. So eventually you could accomplish what Jim said, but I wanted to clarify.
Yep.
He misspoke a little bit on that and said roll it into her 401k.
Oh, no, that was definitely misspoke, because my mouth said one thing, but my brain was thinking something else.
I know what your brain
else.
Was thinking over there. So,
let's continue on with this question.
To summarize with her, just because her number one goal was to get it all at Fidelity to make ease of management, it sounds like the best thing is to get that inherited 401k, or that his 401k, rolled out into an inherited IRA at Fidelity. That'll get it all under the one roof, and then she can decide how much of it she wants to move into her own account and leave in there to have access to it without the early withdrawal penalty.
Right.
So that's kind of summary what
Perfect.
She should probably do.
So let's continue with his email question.
Yeah.
Here is the advice I would like to provide my sister, and I appreciate your guidance and comments.
Well, I kind of like that we've answered it already, and then we'll see how it fits with his.
That's why I answered it this way.
Very nice.
I wanted to see.
See, I haven't seen this. So
no, you never see any of them.
No.
I don't show them to you. I hide them. I don't even see them half the time. I just pick them up and start reading them. Okay. So here is my advice and her options. And he lists four options for her.
First of all, I'll say you're giving her too many choices probably if you're trying to help her. But
option one.
Yeah.
Move the 401k to Fidelity via a direct transfer.
To what, though?
He doesn't say. Mm. Two. Number two.
Mm-hmm.
Create an inherited IRA at Fidelity. So I'm going to assume one and two are the same. Move the decedent's 401k into an inherited IRA at Fidelity. I think you could have combined one and two together. Three, I should, me, I guess she should, title the inherited 401k, and there's, see, I think he meant IRA because he says, title the inherited 401k as John Smith IRA, deceased April 1st, 2018, for benefit of Jane Smith, beneficiary. My question is, should the title use the term IRA or 401k?
See, he's getting confused. He can't move it out to an inherited 401k at Fidelity.
No, you move it out to an inherited
IRA.
So one thing with titling, first of all, his titling is correct if he was going to title the IRA or his sister was going to title the inherited IRA herself. It would be titled, let's just say, the person who died was John Smith. So he's correct. John Smith, IRA, deceased, 4-1-2018, for benefit of Jane Smith, beneficiary. So that title has everything the IRS wants. The name of the decedent, the account type, IRA, date of death.
And beneficiary.
And it has the word beneficiary. Now, that said, you will not or your sister will not be titling the IRA. There's going to be a little box on the application where you simply check that this is a beneficiary IRA and Fidelity will add their own proper title.
Right.
All's what they're going to ask under that checkbox is the name of the decedent, the date he died, and I believe they want his date of birth. And then they put the title the way they want, and it will reach or match IRS guidelines.
Right.
So you're not actually going to write out the titling.
Right.
It's just going to be a little checkbox. They're going to ask for the name of the decedent, the date of death, and I'm pretty sure they ask for the date of birth of the decedent, and a copy of the death certificate they're going to want to see as well included with that. But he is correct. His titling language is correct. The guy's pretty good, except 401k. Should not say 401k, should say IRA. As we said on a previous podcast, and Chris reiterated today, when you move it from the 401k, it's going to change structure to an IRA. So it'll be an inherited IRA. Number four, we should then instruct Transamerica to directly transfer the 401k to the newly created inherited IRA.
That's not really how it works, right?
Well,
I don't do the just, I'm not in on the
you're not in
fill
on
out
the
paperwork to send it in, but my understanding is this is something you ask your new custodian to suck it away from the other one. You don't direct someone to send it. You actually fill out paperwork at the new place and
if
say,
I can
ask
if
it.
I can
is that opposite? Or?
Yeah. When you move an IRA, what you said is 100% true. If you are going IRA to IRA, they're pulled.
Right.
Think
that's
of pull
what I'm
and push.
Yeah.
Think of pull and push. So if you move one IRA to another IRA, the assets are pulled to that IRA. So the assets will be pulled by the receiving IRA
in this case,
from the delivering IRA. But when a 401k is moved, it's usually pushed.
Oh.
It's usually pushed out of the 401k to the IRA.
So they will have to set up the IRA
first
so it's ready for stuff to
so
be pushed into it.
We help people with inherited accounts because they are different. There's a little bit of different step because you're moving to a different account type. You're not going IRA to IRA or 401k to 401k. You're going 401k in someone else's name to IRA. Here's most likely the way it will happen. He should contact Transamerica and move it at Transamerica, because this will be the easiest, into a properly titled inherited 401k or a properly titled inherited IRA right at Transamerica, and tell them to just leave it there. And because IRAs pull, it would be easier to take the inherited 401k, call up Transamerica and say, we'd like to open a properly titled inherited IRA.
Got it.
And then
pull it
in. I just assisted an iTunian with this very thing recently. They hired us for our advice, and I attended a three-way phone call. So here's what happened. She, the spouse, just happened to have an existing IRA at a different custodian. So we instructed the 401k custodian to push. Remember, 401ks, Chris, are pushed. IRAs are pulled. So we contacted the 401k, gave them all the information, and they pushed the 401k money out directly to the IRA custodian. But the IRA was already existing.
And she wanted it in her own.
And she wanted it in her own. Yeah. This is a little different.
Right.
So you got some moving parts here. So if this was my case, if someone was saying, hey, Jim, help us with this, the easiest way, I would instruct Transamerica, simply take the entire 401k and move it to an inherited IRA. Not my own IRA, an inherited IRA with Transamerica. That gets the titling already into an inherited IRA. Follow me so far?
Yep.
Then she gets a hold of Fidelity and tells them, I want to open up a Fidelity IRA and move my existing inherited IRA over to you. Now Fidelity will pull that by opening the inherited IRA, will properly title it, send transfer paperwork automatically to Transamerica, and pull that money directly to Transamerica.
And to Fidelity.
To Fidelity.
So this is all assuming that she wants to leave some or all of it in an inherited account.
Well, once it's at Fidelity,
about the benefits,
once it's at Fidelity, now she can break some of it out and move it into her own, because she already has an account, he said, at Fidelity.
Right.
And leave some in the inherited.
But
so that's how I would do it.
If she doesn't want access to any of this before 59 and a half, if you say, oh, she's got plenty of assets outside of this, that is an issue, she could have set up her own her own IRA if she doesn't already have one at Fidelity.
Well, let's back up.
And have them push it right in there from the 401k.
He said she has money at Fidelity.
But only as a 401k. Is all he specified.
True. Only as a 401k.
But she might have an IRA there. Right. If not, she could open her own and then just, in one step, have Transamerica push the 401k into her own. But that, again, she'd give up the option or advantage of having some or all of that money available before 59 and a half without a early withdrawal penalty.
Absolutely.
So there's a few things for flexibility reasons you might want to consider.
So then he continues.
Oh, wow. This is a big old one.
From your podcast on inherited IRAs on August 4th, am I wrong in assuming the following two things? One, if she keeps the account as inherited IRA, she can take advantage of the penalty-free pre-59-and-a-half withdrawals.
Yeah. Perfect.
And we just said
that's
yes
true.
Repeatedly.
Yep.
Absolutely. Two, to protect the assets, she should roll the inherited IRA to her own IRA and name her three children as primary beneficiaries. Am I missing anything else? I don't know what he means to protect the assets. It's short of saying that the Supreme Court has ruled an inherited IRA is not a retirement account and is not protected from bankruptcy and we have to assume creditors. So, I don't know what state he's in. If your sister leaves it as an inherited IRA to avoid the 10% early withdrawal penalty, your first assumption is correct. She's allowed to do that. Your second assumption is also correct. That IRA, that inherited IRA, is not protected from creditors and bankruptcy.
Like her own would be.
Like her own would be. So, she could then move it to her own, and then it would be protected from bankruptcy under federal law. And it will protect up to bankruptcy up to $1 million of IRA contributions, but an unlimited amount of money that moved from 401ks. So the 401k would be protected because it was moved from a 401k. Now, that said, there's one caveat. Only states grant creditor protection to IRAs, not the federal government. He doesn't tell me what state he's from. The state of Colorado gives IRAs creditor protection. State of California does not. So you have to really look at the state you live in to see if your IRA is going to be protected from creditors or not. But it will be protected from bankruptcy when your sister finally moves it to her own. Am I missing anything else to consider? Thanks in advance. Oh, wait a minute. He's from California. Mm. So I would assume if the sister is also in California, her IRA may not be protected from creditors. State of California does not give as good creditor protection as the state of Colorado does. Bankruptcy protection is afforded at the federal level, though. So, anyways, that was a pretty good email. Hopefully people learned a lot from that.
I think he was, like a lot of people who have listened to the show for a while, they get pretty close. They kind of are starting to put it together, but then they're kind of at the edges, might be a little bit off. So he was mostly correct in his thinking, but I think he still believed he could open an inherited 401k at Fidelity for her, and that's not happening. That cannot happen. Nor can those funds roll over from the Transamerica 401k into her own 401k. That can't happen.
No.
Somehow it's got to hit an IRA at Fidelity to get it to Fidelity.
And again, the easiest way, because her inherited IRA doesn't exist yet, you could always open it at Fidelity, get an account number, and Transamerica can push the money then. But now you especially if you want it to go into two separate accounts, you got to get Transamerica to push some to one account, push some to another. Might be easier just to have Transamerica open it as an inherited IRA and then have Fidelity pull
it the way you want.
Have Fidelity pull some to your own IRA, have Fidelity pull the rest to an inherited IRA, and then Fidelity will combine the inherited IRA with her own after age 59 and a half.
By her request, not automatically.
If she wants to. Yeah. All right. I think that covers it for today's show. Are we hitting an hour yet?
No, we just hit an hour.
Perfect.
So pretty much perfect timing if we want to keep it to about that time.
Yes. So we got through four questions, technically three, but I believe since I count sheets of paper, we got four questions answered from three listeners. So we're down to... What are we down
23.
To? 23. Well, so we're back to where we started last week, 23.
At least we're not losing ground
anymore.
Because
we got four this week. All right. Well, listeners, I want to thank you very much. This was another episode of the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition. Chris and I are going to try to record, so it should hopefully be playing next week. This show is actually going to come out somewhere around September 15th by the time you can listen to it. Somewhere around September 20th, 21st. Is going to be the first Retirement and IRA Show EDU education, where we're going to take one topic and really drill down into that one topic, not necessarily an email question, could just be a topic, unique concept for the Retirement and IRA Show. We're going to get away from the Q&A format on this particular EDU show, and we hope to have both shows coming out weekly, one on Thursday, one on Saturday. Let's see how this all works as we try to pull this all together. So I'm hoping that next Thursday, or this coming Thursday, by the time you're listening to this, we have our first EDU show where we're going to drill down into a certain topic a little bit deeper. I have a feeling I know what our first topic's going to be. It's going to be an email question, but one that we're going to really, really drill down into. Anyways, that's about it. And always keep in mind, folks, we are live, living, breathing, practicing financial planners in the state of Colorado, but we work with people throughout the United States. We have a very unique business model. We specialize with do-it-yourselfers. We love do-it-yourselfers. We have no intention of managing your assets. You do not have to hire us to manage your assets. We don't base our advice on assets under management and charge you 1%, 1.25%, 1.5%, 2% to manage your assets where you're spending tens of thousands of dollars a year for questionable financial planning advice. You want our financial planning advice, and we specialize in distribution planning on the retirement side. I know it's shocking, Chris. You simply pay for our advice. We're going to give you a flat price. We're going to tell you what we're going to charge, and we charge you for our advice, and we give you advice. How you implement that advice, who you implement it through, whether you do it on your own or hire someone else to help you, is totally up to you. You're under no obligation to work with us. You're simply paying for our advice. And that's just how we work. So if you're interested in that, you want to find out more about what we do, You simply schedule what we call a coffee and a second opinion. Go to our website, Jim Helps. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Click on the schedule a meet. What is it? Schedule a meeting or schedule a coffee and a second opinion? I don't know what it's called. It's on the homepage in the upper left-hand side of the website. And you just schedule your own phone call, and we'll chat with you over the phone, answer your questions, and let you know how working with us may be structured.
Perfect. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.